Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey everybody, it's Todd. Before we start this episode, I thought I would give a little intro. Given everything that's going on in the world, I'm just really heartbroken and frustrated and quite frankly, kind of lost in terms of what to say or do. So I reached out to Amma because we had had this incredible conversation about a project that really opened my eyes to a lot of things that I had not been thinking about it. And I have to admit that I'm not a scholar. I'm not an intellectual by any stretch. I'm a filmmaker and I mostly make comedies. So I'm probably the least qualified person to actually talk about racism. I admit that I'm stumbling through a lot of this interview that you're about to listen to because I'm ignorant in a lot of ways and have been in a lot of ways in terms of not opening my eyes to what was going on. And quite frankly, probably because it was painful and worrisome and scary, probably turning a blind eye a lot of the times. And I want to apologize for that because I know that that has been a huge part of the problem. And since my eyes have been opened now, I'm vowing not to be part of the problem anymore. So this podcast is just a tiny little bit of a sliver of what I want to do, but it's all that I know how to do in this moment since I'm a filmmaker that can't make movies right now. And so all I have right now is this podcast to just talk a little bit about like what, as filmmakers, what can we do to help in any way in this situation? And that's what I attempted to do. And I'm stumbling and struggling because I'm just finding my way through this like everybody else. And so if you have anything that I got wrong or anything you want to say to me, I'm listening because I want to learn more and I'm learning every day. And I welcome any conversations that this might inspire and freely admit that I barely know anything about this. And I'm just terribly, terribly sorry for that part that I've played in it. So thank you for listening.
All right. I'm here with Amma Asante. Hello, Amma.
Hi, Todd. How are you doing?
Oh, I've been better. It's a weird,
right?
Shitty time. Where are you right now? Where am I speaking with you?
I'm currently in Denmark. I'm married to a Dane, so we do spend some time out here. He actually works out here. And this is where we've been on lockdown since it started, really.
Right. Well, the reason why I wanted to have you on today is you and I had spoken a couple weeks ago about a project that unfortunately did not go forward with each other, but that's okay. But I hung up wishing I had recorded our conversation because it was so great to talk to you. And it was over an hour, which usually doesn't happen on a project call. And
for sure,
I hung up and I called you right back and I said, would you do this? Because the things we were talking about were so felt so relevant 2 weeks ago and an even sickeningly more relevant now.
Isn't it terrible? Isn't it just awful how relevant, you know, what can happen in the shortest space of time is incredible sometimes. Gosh.
And the reason why I wanted to have you on right now is because all of your work, I mean, you've directed 4 movies, A Way of Life, Belle, A United Kingdom, and Where Hands Touch. And you've done incredible work as a director on Handmaid's Tale and Mrs. America. And you're a writer and all of your work is infused with really socially important and relevant themes of racism and sexism and just historical, you know, inadequacies. And the project we were talking about, which we don't have to talk about, had racial undertones in it. And so walk me through how you became a writer-director. And when you're choosing your projects and you're choosing what to write, because you said something that was so interesting to me, because it's what Rod Serling did back in The Twilight Zone, which is you said, you know, it's sometimes easier to look at social inadequacies such as racism and sexism in a historical perspective, which is what Rod Serling used to do on The Twilight Zone. And so just walk me through, like, when you pick your projects and you know, like Belle and Where Hands Touch, how do you begin and kind of what is your North Star when you're thinking about writing and directing the projects that you take on?
It's so funny because I think in so many ways, you know, all of the questions that you're asking, the answers kind of lie in my first film, A Way of Life, which was a film that wasn't released in the US, but, you know, kind of opened up my career for me in the UK. I won a BAFTA for it and some other international awards. And when I made it in a bubble. I had no concept that it would really reach any audiences at all beyond perhaps a very local audience. I made it in South Wales, which is not where I'm from, but nevertheless, it is a story about a Brit young woman. And I had a really incredible producer who, his notes used to come in the form of questions. They were always questions, and they were always questions that got under my skin and stayed with me for, you know, days after he would ask them. And then somehow within my answers would come the fix that was necessary for the script. He just had a way. And I remember sitting and having a conversation with him before I started writing that script. And he said, you know, we understand and we get that not all racism is a symptom, right? We understand some people's just bad and there's nothing you can do about that. And even when racism is a symptom, the results of it are just bad. And so, but what would happen if we looked at some of what we're delving into here, and I'll tell you about that in a second, as a symptom, what would you think the cause would be? And what he was talking about was the fact that I was telling, we had been researching this kind of phenomena in the UK of girl-led gang violence. So the gangs were of guys, but there'd be one central female. That seemingly the way the papers reported it would be leading these gangs into terrible, terrible violence, which led to murder. And what I discovered as I started exploring all of these is that a few of them had quite a racial element in them. And the racial element wasn't always as obvious for me as a young woman, perhaps as it is today. And what I mean by that is, you know, it would be... a person who wasn't necessarily black like me who would be murdered, but they would be deemed as different. So they might be a Turkish person or a Muslim whose skin was much paler than mine. And they would be, you know, targeted because of their religion and because they were different and because they were an outsider. And oftentimes there was definitely a class element that was involved in this. So the kids that, were doing it were white kids, usually very marginalized. I think, you know, they would be deemed as coming from a portion of society, which at the time I would definitely say were, and probably still are, you know, socially outcast. And we as people of color or people who were from different religions or whatever it is became the sort of the reason for their angst, you know, the thing to blame for why they were in the situations and the positions that they were in. And we're talking about, you know, multi-generational unemployment, kids who had never seen their parents work before, kids who came from communities that really were once communities and had, you know, the life really ripped out of them. So, you know, the livelihoods, if they were coal mining communities, you know, the coal mining industry was gone, you know, libraries were gone, you know, schools had been closed down. And these kids felt, or seemingly seemed to feel, really outcast. And so I wanted to tell a story that looked at how class impacts, you know, and class and social exclusion can sometimes, you know, lead to what I experienced as a kid, which was just straight up, you know, straight up racism. And from that film, really, I didn't know what I was doing. I was trying to tell a story and understand what the thinking can be when you get yourself into a situation where you kill someone, you find yourself killing someone because you deem them so different to you that it feels okay, or you deem them to be to blame for so many things that are wrong in your life when you don't even know them, you don't even know what their life is. You don't even know what the reality of their experience in life is, that it, you make it okay in your head. And I really told that story from her point of view, you know, this 17-year-old teenage mother's point of view. It was much, as much a social commentary about the exclusion of those kids as it was the racism that they expressed. And going on from there, what was very interesting, you know, I thought I was really going to be hung out to dry for that movie. I thought, you know, the critics are going to come after me. And, you know, how dare this, you know, usually my people are on the end of the social commentary. It would usually be white filmmakers telling stories about, you know, the problems within Black communities and Black society. And here I was, this Black woman, you know, turning that round and choosing to tell stories about what might have gone wrong with, you know, Britain's excluded white kids. And I thought, you know, I would be punished for that as a woman of color. And that didn't happen. That didn't happen in that film. And that, as I was making that film, I thought about what I might want to do next. Really, it was sort of as award season was coming up and I was starting to get nominated, and I had never expected that to happen. And I thought, oh, maybe I might be allowed to make another film. So what would I want to do? And that second film I thought about was Where Hands Touch. And it's because at that point, once I realized the power of film and what I could explore with film, I wanted to explore more about people like me who were of African descent, but were Europeans, you know, were born and raised in Europe. What I wanted to know what that history was. And what happened was that film was deemed too big for me at that time. And I then decided that I was going to have to make another film instead. You know, whatever film I might be allowed to make to prove that I could make Where Hands Touch, and that film was Belle.
Wow.
And so it wasn't a sort of planned, I'm gonna do social commentary through period drama. And that's kind of gonna be my brand. That wasn't really how it worked. It was more, I needed to do Belle to prove why I could do, you know, to prove why such films were not too big for me. And A United Kingdom fell into the same, you know, sort of fell into the same basket, if you like. But I realized what I noticed as I was doing those, that was that I was able to explore some real difficult stuff, but in a way that kind of allowed people to think about it after they left the movie theater. But didn't make them so uncomfortable in their seats while they were in the movie theater that they rejected everything I was presenting to them.
Right. Wow. I mean, there's so much to unpack there. It's so fascinating how, you know, just as filmmakers in the media and you know, and I look at Mrs. America, your episodes of that, and of course The Handmaid's Tale, and there's just, mm-hmm. it's, you know, there was such a moment, it probably lasted like 10 years, where specifically African American movies of mm-hmm. a time were considered quote unquote urban. And then there was this, you know, push from people who made just movies to pull away from that quote unquote urban experience mm-hmm. and just make mm-hmm. movies that, you know, mm-hmm. maybe starred an African American in them, you know, and I really tried to, you know, just make movies that happen to have, you know, African Americans in them, or Crazy Rich Asians, just a love story that happens to have Asian, you know, the mm-hmm. experience mm-hmm. in it. But now it's like, with everything that's going on, and again, you and I talked about this before, and I'll just admit it again, mm-hmm. from somebody who is white and has a white experience, and I just can't put myself in either position, and it just feels so helpless. Like, I can't put myself in a racist person's position that would do something awful or say something awful. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm getting emotional. And
it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
And I can't put myself in my Black friend's place, so I'm stuck. And I feel I feel paralyzed, you know.
But I think it's so important that you are able to acknowledge that. And I think, you know, part of what we're hearing in the conversation now and what we've been hearing, you know, since, you know, for a long time, certainly all of my adult life, is that it isn't the super you know, white supremacist, you know, obvious racist who comes out and basically, you know, wearing it on his or her sleeve that tells you that they're racist, that is the scariest thing. It's a scary thing. That's a scary thing. I grew up in a part of London where an element of white supremacy, you know, existed within, you know, one of our far right wing groups. And that's scary. It's scary as a 10-year-old to grow up around that. But I think what is most scary to me and what's most difficult for me are the people who think they get it, right, and think they don't need to. You know, it's something that I struggle with, you know, to make sure I remember all the time. You know, if you have a friend who loses a loved one, or you have a friend and who, God forbid, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, loses a child, and you never say, oh, I can imagine. You never say that. Well, you shouldn't ever say that, because unless you have gone through that, you can't say I can imagine. You just have to listen, and you have to acknowledge how, you know, what that person is telling you it feels like, because if you haven't been through it yourself, you can't ever imagine, and God knows you shouldn't have to. And I think that for you to be able to say, well, I don't know what it feels like to be either, is honest and is fair. And what that means is that you allow yourself to be in a position, therefore, where you listen. And that's what I'm so grateful for, because when we talked about that movie and you know, the movie that you brought to me, what happens so often, I think, for people who aren't in the film industry, but they love films, they like going to the movie theater and watching films, is that they never imagine that the filmmaker whose work they're going to see ever turns down work, or that there's a process that they go through where they say, am I right for this project? Am I the best person for this project? Can I do this project justice? Or do I understand the workings, the inner workings of this project? Or is this project, you know, is this project simply too painful for me? And if it's too painful for me, or if it's, you know, repeating a story that I've told before, you know, perhaps this isn't right for me. I think oftentimes moviegoers don't necessarily think that filmmakers do go through that process, and we do. And for me, what I was grateful for is that you listened. And as I, you know, as I explained to you why for me, and we have to say that, you know, when you sent me this film, it was prior to the most recent events that have just happened, with, you know, I'll just come out and say it, with George Floyd. What I was communicating to you was this was a piece that was not just difficult, but also painful.
Right.
And when you make films and you commit to a film, you're committing to a chunk of your life, you know, kind of you're submerged in the topics and the sort of realities. And for a film like the one we were talking about, it felt, everything feels too present, is what I was saying. And you listened. And I think the other thing that happens is that for people who are not going through it in the space that people of color and black people are going through it in, is sometimes I wonder whether they realize that the level of pain and the level of grief that exists, and the level of fear that exists. You know, when we didn't grow up in America, we grew up in the UK and we grew up in South London. And I remember my dad, my brother's 10 years older than me, and I remember my dad regularly having the talk with my brother, your job is to come home alive. Your job is to come home safe. And yes, we have a slightly different experience in the UK, that's true. But there are massive overlaps. There are massive overlaps. And at the time when I was being raised, to disappear, you know, and be and to have your mother end up finding out that you were taken into a police station the night before and you just will never come out of that police station was not in London, in Brixton, and was not I'm not going to say it happened every day, it didn't, but it happened. And it happened, you know, it happened to school colleagues of my brother. And so you know, every time a situation like this comes up, although I am not African American, it's painful. And for me to then sort of be involved in a project that would have me sort of confronting that every day, especially when I've just come out of a very dark project as well, right, Hands Touch, I knew would be tough. And I think it's appropriate that you listened. And so I think it's okay to also tell yourself that you should be frustrated. It's right for you to be frustrated. We are in a really frustrating situation. The world is really frustrating right now. And I think it's right. I don't think you should beat yourself up about that.
Well, thank you. Because I just, you know, I see it. You know, I'm not blind. I see it. But because I don't have that experience, even just like, you know, going out and having dinner and, you know, driving in Los Angeles and all the things that you can point to, all of these victims that have just been doing, you know, banal, just everyday things and not coming home.
Yeah.
That just that level of fear and anxiety just doesn't resonate with me in terms of my own experience. So it's hard as a filmmaker to project that fear that you must have or anyone must have that's in that situation. And so not to just belabor it and wallow in it, what can we all do, because this is a filmmaker's podcast, what can we do as filmmakers? What do you feel is the right appropriate actions for us to start to take now as filmmakers, both white and black? And again, I can't put myself in your experience. I can't put myself in my African-American friends that are actors' experience or filmmakers' experience. I only have my experience from coming from, you know, San Fernando as a white person living almost entirely in the Latino culture. And then, you know, so, but I'm not Latino. So it's like, what can we all do, or what advice do you have for filmmakers going forward, knowing that this is all happening, to be positive for change as opposed to reactionary towards the violence and the destruction?
Sure. Wow. That's such a big question. And I think I want to begin my answer by saying, you know, as black people, of the diaspora, we're definitely not a monolith. And so these are really just my thoughts as a filmmaker, you know, my individual thoughts as a filmmaker who is both black and, you know, female as well. I mean, for me as a filmmaker, what would be helpful for me, I think, is a couple of things. One is that, you know, when you find the right filmmaker for your project, and you will, and I'm almost 100% sure that that filmmaker will be a black filmmaker. When you do, you know, listen, as I was saying before, you know, listen to why they have the point of view that they have, they as an individual, because I think, you know, the key thing is that whilst there are massive overlaps with gays, you know, that are tuned by your experiences and your culture and the society and the neighborhood that you come from and all of that, we're just unique. And out, and that's the interesting thing, right? That's why you pick a particular filmmaker, is that you like some unique qualities that they have in the work that they project. So within the context of that, you know, listen to what they have to say. And then the other thing I would say is have other black people, if the story is, a you know, has a black lead and is about, you know, a situation that massively affects us as a society, but really affects specifically people of color and black people, then have other people who are on your team so that conversations can be had. Because I remember when I was making Belle, you know, when I was writing the scripts for Belle, and I just say out right now, you know, I spent 3 years writing the scripts for Belle and then lost my credit with the Writers Guild of Los Angeles or of Writers Guild West. When I was at the time where I didn't know that was going to happen, and if I did, I never would have written as many drafts as I did, or any drafts. But at the time when I was working and writing my scripts, I remember, you know, I lived in Holland at the time, and I would have to fly in. That was due to my husband's work, and I'd have to fly into London and sit down with one of our main financiers and get notes. And you know, there was a key man, male actually, of color on that team. He was specifically biracial, who asked me the right questions and told me small pieces of his experience that didn't necessarily sort of gel with what I had done in some early drafts, or didn't necessarily gel with my experience, but they gave me food for thought. And, you know, working in that way where ideas and thoughts can be bounced, and we operate in a way that doesn't treat the communities as a monolith, by making sure different perspectives are represented. And listen, the filmmaker will always be the filmmaker, and it's their vision. And I definitely, you know, I'm 100% behind that. You know, any film that I've ever made that anybody has ever enjoyed or liked, I believe that they've liked it because I, as a filmmaker, have had a great relationship with my team, and in particular, my producer and producers, because I need that. I need those ears to be able to bounce stuff off of. I need that heart and that passion to be able to, you know, call someone at 10 o'clock in the night and say, you know what, I can't get this scene done because I'm thinking about A, B, or C. And maybe what they say is, you know, is completely rejected. Maybe I completely reject it, but because of that conversation, I come up with a better way than I did before I had the conversation. And I think those conversations can't be had and shouldn't be had, I think, even on projects that don't have white characters, you know, sorry, black characters necessarily at the forefront. I don't think that they can be had from, you know, in situations where you feel like it's a monolithic point of view that's coming at you, even though it might not be a monolithic point of view. There's enough overlap in the point of view that it feels like it's monolithic. And I think that that's what you can do. I think that the second thing at the same time is to also commit to telling stories that let us just be. And that's what I'm looking forward to also next. Is, you know, I've said it before and I'm going to stop saying it. You're the last person I'm going to say this to, but you know, I would love to get to the point one day where I can write a movie or direct a movie or do both about a woman who, you know, invents a Hoover or a broom. And she happens to be black, and it's okay. And what I mean by that, I'm not for one minute, you know, necessarily speaking of the item, but I'm saying something as mundane and everyday as that, where is shows you the fact that a filmmaker can tell a story about and get an amazing actress to tell a great story like that, which is essentially about someone who invents something as everyday as that, tells you the kind of freedom that white people have in being right. able to tell their stories, and white actors have in, excuse me, the kind of stories that they then portray. And I can tell you right now, if I did that, people would be like, what?
Yes.
What is that? You want me to finance, really? You know, it's so important that our stories right now are either so important or so urban.
I completely understand what you're saying. I completely understand that. It's always weighted. It has to be the first of, you know, like, yeah. like, or, you know, or, you know,
I'm
like,
the queen of that,
like Hidden Figures, you know, the first time that ever happened, or, you know, it's gotta be always something so remarkable, as opposed to just great characters that are doing something mundane and just everyday life and still be fascinating, yeah. and still yeah. be deep and still be interesting. I totally understand what you're saying about that. And And that, I agree. That's absolutely hugely important, just to have different perspectives of ordinary life. It doesn't always have to be historical or significant.
There's a freedom in that.
Yeah.
There's a freedom in that. And I think, you know, our kids and our families, our husbands, our wives, we, you know, the other kind of film that I talked about is really important, to be able to walk other members of our communities and our societies in our shoes for 2 hours as far as is possible, when you haven't had that experience yourself, right? And film, I think, is, and TV, great TV, are the closest ways we can do that, is to be able to give you an idea, just an idea for a few minutes, what it might feel like to be in somebody else's shoes. And this, you know, and the same for me, right? And this is what I discovered. I made my first film, and it's a thing that made me want to be a filmmaker. I take my film to Argentina, and there are all these Argentinian women in the audience and men who are identifying with the world that from South Wales, you know, that I've put forward to them. And so it's really important to tell those stories too, for, because I think, you know, not everybody's going to watch a documentary, and not everybody's going to read the New York Times, and not everybody's going to listen to, you know, a news channel, but they might see a movie on streaming, or they might, you know, pay $20 to go and see a movie and for a few minutes be given some food for thought. But it's also important for us to have respite as well, because it is exhausting. It is exhausting. And whilst we fight the good fight, which is for equality and for the right for our, you know, and certainly for people to go out and come home alive and literally not be murdered by the very people who are supposed to protect them, but, you know, come home alive and not be killed for not doing really very much at all. Whilst we that good fight is being fought, then respite. And I think actually film has a real important part to play in terms of how human beings are viewed, how we as Black people and people of colour are viewed, the fear that exists, or the fear that is purported to exist amongst the people who choose to commit these murders. And the fact that they can, you know, when they do get away with these murders, the idea that we are terrifying people just for being, also has come from a portrayal on the screen at times as well. You know, popular culture plays into how different groups in society are viewed. And so by letting us be, we also present a different idea of and a more realistic idea, the correct idea of who we are as people.
Because it's what you're saying, just by making movies about all different stories of families and love and relationships, even though we're all different, it's connecting by having it be stories that relate to everybody's experiences, love, family, you know, work, you know,
exactly.
The way that people connect, the way that people interact. By seeing that, I hate to say normalizes, but it makes you feel connected to it. Like, oh, that's exactly the way I deal with that situation. Or I've been in that situation with my wife or lover or children. And it connects you, because there's this us and them thing. Right. I mean, by the way, there's even this us and them thing in this pandemic. Right. There's like you go out or you stay in. So there's this you can feel that fear and hatred and vitriol being thrown through social media and other places just from the masks thing. The us and them thing of just like what you're saying, of like the way that Black people are sometimes described in different content forms. The more that we can just tell real stories of real people that happen to be different than you, the more that we can feel connected to them and be like, oh my God, they're exactly like me, which is obviously my friends and the people that I work with and the people that I interact with every day. I feel that because I get to know them and I have a close-knit relationship with them and feel that, oh my God, you're, and by the way, there's urban white people that are more you know, stereotypically in the media one way, and there's black people that are more stereotypically, you know, in other cultures. Like, there's just that's the thing that we don't account. It always feels like it's just that thing you've seen on the screen. You know, when you say a redneck, you just instantly get that picture in your mind because we've seen it portrayed in media. And then when something matches up in real life, you throw it into that bucket.
Right. And it can be quite terrifying. And I think what we know from history, right? It goes back to, you know, period pieces again. But what we know from history is that when you are trying to make it easier to dispose of people when you dehumanize the group that they come from first. When you don't allow all kinds of human stories to be told and seen in popular culture, I'm going to say popular culture here because it's really important, then you make it easier for juries to make excuses for why.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I can see why he was he felt threatened. I can see why he was scared, even though it was a 15-year-old boy who, you know, you make it easier. And so, you know, what I'm talking about is building blocks, and it's one small thing in a world where art and culture can contribute to a better kind of conversation, and definitely isn't the game changer and the only thing, but it can contribute to a bigger conversation in which all parts of society must take part.
Yeah, when you're talking about history and the dehumanization, it's the caricature that is the thing that wins the day. You know, so if you think about the Nazi propaganda, the caricature of the Jews at that time, or the caricature of Asians during World War II, like if you highlight the stereotypical things and you blow those things up to make them caricatures, it's much easier to not see them as human beings. It's much easier to see
them. You can laugh at them. You can kill them. I mean, I'm just doing some research at the moment on the kind of sort of early 20th century, so kind of like 1910 to 1920. And, you know, I'm looking at vaudeville and I'm looking at blackface and I'm looking at, you know, what was just so normal to have on a playbill or a music bill at that time. You know, I'm stunned. I had no idea that in some circumstances, some situations, I know this would probably sound crazy, but blame it on the fact that I'm a Brit. I had no idea that even black people were made to black up, even black performers blacked up, blackface. During that time. And it's you know, those caricatures that just completely made them laughable characters, and when there were certain key characters who had previously sort of used that platform as a kind of stepping stone to then try and present more serious content, you know, within the theatre world, they were ridiculed, and also white people didn't like it. You know, I think there was one character that I was reading about, one actor who went from blackface to doing a piece where there was a sort of love story thread in the play that he was doing, and the criticism came that, well, why do we need to see these people trying to play at what we do, you know, falling in love and doing all that normal stuff that we do? If we want to see that, we'll go and see white actors. This isn't what we come to see black people in the theater performing for us do. Right. Essentially, be human. So it's fascinating as I'm sort of studying all of that now for a different project. I'm very aware, and I think that part of the reason why, you know, important stories about important black people are being told in cinema and in film, and particularly over, let's say, the last 10 or 15 years or so, not saying it didn't happen a little bit before, but we see more of it in the last few years, is because those stories have been left out of schools. Those stories have been, you know, children have not been taught those stories. And because we've either gone from being the drug addicts and the prostitutes, or, as I keep saying, you know, the person who comes out and says, "Mrs. Collins, your son is going to your son is going to die, and then Mrs. Collins goes off and has a whole film storyline. And, you know, we're just the key doctor at the beginning that came to deliver the line that allowed the story to take off. That it feels like we're still in the early stages of cinema when it comes to storytelling about Black characters, and we have to kind of set the record straight before we can then go on and just tell the ordinary stories. We have to say, wait, once we were kings, you know.
Right.
Wait, we were aristocrats too, you know. We weren't only, colonized peoples or people that you took from Africa and treated the way you did. We did have scientists, and we did have, we had other stories to tell as well. And we haven't, those stories haven't been told. And until they're told, it's kind of like, how can you then move on and tell those other stories that we've just been talking about, you know? So I can see why it happens. And I know that's why I do it to a certain extent. I want to set the record straight.
Well, also, filmmakers and especially writers can't take the easy way out, right? When you're stuck, you can't just revert back to, wow, man, I need a best friend. Oh, I'll just make him the African-American best friend. Oh, that'll be good. Where does he live? Oh, he's definitely from Chicago. Oh, and he likes sport. Like, you can't just, I need a gay best friend because that will be cool. And so then it's like, that's the problem, is that it's easy. It's easy to write that, and it's easy to fall into that trap. I think that for us as filmmakers, normalizing and bringing and exploring our similarities as opposed to magnifying the differences, it feels like it could be helpful.
I think what you speak about there, in a way, is sort of falls loosely into that basket of identity politics. In a way, when you have a situation where the people who could be playing those roles never get the chance to play the roles that they most closely resemble, they never get the chance. And the people who continuously get the work are taking up all of the work. And when you get to a place where there is more equality, and where, you know, 90% of work doesn't go to 10% of the kind of same looking people, or, you know, people who talk the same or are of the same religion or who exist in the same way, then once again, we'll be in a space where it becomes, there's a kind of new kind of democracy, where if everybody has, I'm not saying everybody can have work, I understand everybody can't have work, but where there's an even spread of the work, a more even spread of the work, I think then there would be less worry about who's playing who and why. And you realize that right now, if you think of it in terms of, a white person browning up to play somebody from the Middle East, for instance, when we know that Middle Eastern actors just are not getting enough work, and Americans of Middle Eastern descent just don't rock up in shows and figure on a regular basis in the way that white people do.
Yep.
Right. And when that becomes a reality, where literally you are not playing to any stereotypes, but you're just bringing somebody in because we're saying this is a true reflection of the world. If I get on the subway, or if I go into the hospital, or if I go into the bank or whatever, then I'm likely to come across somebody who is an American from somewhere else of descent. Then I hope I'm making sense here, we're in a space where those identity issues become less of a problem, because the work is spread. It's just when the same people are getting the work all of the time, I think then that's when it becomes, you will get people pointing out the fact that if I don't have the work, where the hell, there is one job that I could have totally.
Here's how seriously I take it. And Anne New Line took it, even as something as seemingly innocuous as Mortal Kombat. We genuinely looked at it, but it's not even real. And we looked at the game, the backgrounds that the game developers had given the characters in terms of their nationalities and backstories. And we absolutely cast based on the nationalities that were created in the game.
Now, that's Interesting.
Now, granted, some of them are aliens and clones, and then we could be a little bit more, loose on the interpretation of someone's an alien planet or created from a clone. But otherwise, we really, if somebody was Japanese, they were Japanese, or someone was Chinese, they really did take that very seriously and look to cast the right people. You said something I want to go back to real quick, which is so great in terms of just filmmaking in general, which is that you mentioned it twice, that when someone was giving you notes, they asked questions rather than telling you what to do. Mm. And that is such a good point and such a good note, because I think that a lot of people, I do it. I'm definitely, in the interest of time and stress and deadlines, yes. I'll go, okay, here are my notes. You got to do this. You got to do this, flip this, that, as opposed to taking the time to really ask the question, could you dive a little bit deeper into kind of what those questions look like? And just as a filmmaker / writer, well, I guess that's the same, kind of what that process was like.
Yeah, so I think that oftentimes, and I just want to talk about my first ever producer on a film, because I think, he was the first person that I experienced it with, and I actually think he was the best at it. And he passed away a couple of years ago, Peter Edwards, but he really was bloody amazing. And so oftentimes I think it would come up if I had made an easy decision about a character, or if I'd made a more complicated decision about a character that he didn't understand, he wouldn't then ask me a question that, this kind of straight answer would be just explaining, a sort of cultural difference or that kind of thing. He would, let's go back to the easy character version. If I'd made an easy decision about a character, he would ask me a question which would technically be saying to me, you have made a lazy choice. That's what he would, the note, the version,
right.
The question would be, you've made a lazy choice here, or you've made a cliched choice here. And that would be the straightforward note. But the question, I'm not as clever as he is, so it's really, really hard to, but the question would be, do you wonder whether, it would probably start with, do you wonder whether, without giving you a scenario, it's difficult to think of, but that, do you wonder whether,
that's a great way to start.
It probably would annoy me to begin with. And then I would go home, and usually I'd have a 2-hour journey home on the train at this point when he would put these questions to me. So all the train journey, it'd be going through my mind. And then I'd get home and go, what a stupid question. And then the next day or the day after, I would have this kind of ping moment where I'd go, oh, like her just like coming straight out of her house and calling him, using some straightforward racist language is just too easy. Mm-hmm. It's just too easy. What he's trying to say to me is the reality is that she would be more complicated than that. The reality is that probably something would have happened in her home that would cause her to come out and take it out on this neighbor. But it would be, and when she comes out and takes it out, she would probably be utterly racist towards him without ever uttering a racist word.
Yeah.
But her behavior would be, and by having her just come out for kind of no reason, because she's kind of looking out the window and she sees that neighbor that seems to be getting all the government support in the whole wide world at the moment, where she feels like she gets nothing, which is what this character was in my first film, and just have her spot him and just feel like that's a reason to go out and insult him is a lazy way, and come out with a really kind of direct racist statement is probably a really lazy way to have approached it. Isn't there a more complicated way of doing this? But the question wouldn't be stated. He wouldn't say to me, isn't there a more complicated way? He would say, right. Do you ever wonder whether?
Huh. rather than just saying it's lazy, fix it.
Yeah. And I got to be honest. I mean, there were times, especially as we got closer to production, where you have to do that. You just have to say, I don't think that works because A, B, C, D. But I would say, well, we were really in development and, you know, we were not greenlit and we just had time. I have to say, it's the fastest script I ever wrote as well. It wasn't quick, but I think within 2 years, I think from script to first day of principal photography was about 2 years. Wow. And from a blank page, a completely blank
page.
That's
amazing.
So I think that it was so, but you know, in that first year we had time, and when you have time and you can just sit and have a coffee and you can sit in an office for a couple of hours and just talk these thoughts through. And despite the fact that I would, you know, sometimes go home thinking, what is that question? What I felt was a safety in the fact that this producer that I had just cared.
Yeah.
You know, well, that he had time to give to this project, you know, and shoot the breeze with me.
Yeah, well, asking questions shows that you care and that you're trying to dig a little deeper. And by the way, I think just asking that question is a great question. Is, you know, do you wonder if you're being cliche or lazy right now? Are you taking the shortcut, which is what we were talking about before, which is the more people do that in content, whatever it is, the more it's going to keep perpetuating this divide between us all, you know, whether it be the, you know, the white guy who's just wears the suit and does cocaine and he's an evil banker, or, you know, whatever the stereotypes are that everybody, that we keep falling back on because it's easy, because at least I can just get this script done and I can get this thing out there. The more that I think we're going to keep perpetuating this divide between us, and the more you can see the simple stories, like you were saying, the more that we can kind of come together, because that's, we have to.
Peter also said something else that has stayed with me forever and will never leave me as well. It's really simple, but it's been really important to me through writing and directing. And it came just as I was, and it goes to what you're saying here. It came just as we'd been invited to a film festival in Argentina, and I went into a panic. I'm an anxiety freak. And I went into a complete panic and said, you know, do you not feel that this film is so local? I mean, it was deliberately written, you know, for an audience in the UK, specifically for an audience in Wales, not because Wales specifically suffers any more than, you know, with the issues we were dealing with than any other part of the UK. It's just, it was really, really local in its world and, you know, to that part of the world. And in the detail, and he said to, and I said, you know, at the time we were going to Argentina, and I said, I don't know that they'll get it, and then they'll hate my film because, you know, they won't get it because it's so local. And he said, listen, in the detail you get the universal. When you focus on the detail, that's how you tell a universal story. When you try and tell a universal story, so you just you know you go for all the obvious, and This is how Latinos behave, and this is how Black people behave, and this is how white people behave. You get a generic kind of weird, inauthentic blur of nothingness. But when you focus on the detail of somebody's world, so the detail of my character's world in that very, very first film was that she was struggling with her child. And she wasn't struggling with her child because she was a kind of bad mother who went out drinking all night and wasn't, but she was struggling with her child because she was young and she just didn't know, and she was poor and the system wasn't helping her. And yes, at times she wasn't helping herself either, but how to break that down in the detail of her life, how to break down that sometimes really horrible things happen in really beautiful places, and sometimes really beautiful things happen in really horrible places. And for me, that beauty was, you know, because she lived in a dive, she lived in a terrible place, but there was all this beauty that existed between her and her 10-month-old baby. And finding the detail of what it's like for a mother, you know, just leaving the camera to sit there for minutes while she and the baby were just in the bath. In this groggy bath that was just covered in mold and, you know, covered in horrible stuff. But when you've seen this teenage mother, you know, literally beg for for her electricity to be switched back on in a government office that has the lights on during the day and won't give her what she needs so that she can have hot water to be able to bathe her child. And what I discovered at the time when I was researching that was that, you know, obviously housing has everything to do with your, with the quality of your child's health and the quality of your health. And so there's a catch-22 situation. If you don't have electricity, then your child is more likely to get sick. And if your child is more likely to get sick, then you're more likely to have your child taken away. And if you're poor, then you're more likely to have your child taken away. And, you know, and not necessarily because you're a bad parent, but because you're caught up in a catch-22. And so finding the detail of what did that mean in her everyday life and in her everyday moment, rather than this is what life is like for, you know, for every unemployed single teenage mother, but this is what it's like for her in her specific life, was what eventually resonated with, you know, audiences around the world. And it's that detail, I think, that allows people to be complicated. And that's what I will say about now in filmmaking. What I found now is that, you know, a lot of my my conversations when I'm talking about a character that, say, happens to be black now in one of my scripts, those conversations have become more complicated in the last few years. So while we still have a long way to go, I'm so grateful to actually be able to have complicated conversations about black characters. That's a joy. And that, you know, a producer might not agree with me in a way that allows the complexity of the character to come through, as opposed to, you know, let me tell you, I had one producer with Belle, whose name shall not be mentioned, who at one point just said to me, why would she be so rude? Why would she be so rude to her father? That is not a question that allows the complexity of the character to come through. That is not the kind of Karen conversation I want to be having. And so, you know, and so my answer was equally basic. Well, if we were having this conversation about the Elizabeth character, her white counterpart, would you be asking the same question? No. Right. So those conversations are a little bit less, and the complexity of what is going on with Dido, with Belle in that moment, where she is sitting with her entirely white family with a black paid servant, nevertheless still a black servant, serving her breakfast, and she snaps at her father. The complexity of that moment,
right,
was a conversation that you know I was eventually allowed to have, but didn't start off that way. So that's a good thing. We just need to push for more of that.
The universal is in the details is such a fantastic thing to remember, because it is the details of people's lives that you will connect to the most as just a human.
Yeah. And it's the stuff that allows you that, even if you haven't quite been through the exact same thing, the feeling resonates with you, because it's often, you know, I say to my actors, you know, if I'm directing an actor and I'm directing them in a moment of loss, I will talk to them about a time when I have felt that loss, and it will be about a totally different thing. But the feeling of loss,
right,
is something that you're trying to channel. And that's the detail of what that feels like to the character that the actor is portraying is what's important, I think.
Because I think sometimes we get so lost in thoughts and not feelings. Like anytime mm-hmm. somebody says, I feel that, as soon as you say that, that's a thought. Mm. That's not a feeling. Mm. Like you can feel sad. You can feel angry. You can feel.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But as soon as you say that, I feel that, you're wrong. I feel that person is an asshole.
My gosh.
I feel that. It's the that that makes it a thought. And thoughts are not universal. Thoughts sometimes are very specific to the person having the thought. Feelings are universal.
That's so, yeah, I hear you. Wow. See, that's going to go down along with my details are universal. I love that.
We've come up with two good things for screenwriters in this last.
That's so great. Minute. Yeah.
So speaking of screenwriters, so, you know, ultimately we want to get to a place where you can make a movie about the the woman who invented the Hoover or whatever that whisk jet was, but she happens to be an African-American or black character. What advice would you have for people right now to start to tell those stories? Like what kind of stories would you encourage people to be writing right now that maybe just getting started?
But when I was starting, you know, we were still in that place where, and maybe we still are, I don't know, but where, you know, you were told, write what you know. But I think that that's misleading, because I think that that takes writers to a place where it becomes so literal. So if I grew up in South London, I should only tell stories about other black women who were raised in South London. And I don't think that should necessarily be the case. I think write what you feel really passionate about, what you can submerge your life in for possibly up to the next 7 years. In the UK, it still takes up to, on average, 7 years to get a movie off the ground, a feature film off the ground still.
So
work on a project that if you had to submerge yourself in it for the next decade, it took me 12 years to get Where Hens Touch off the ground, it would be, you could cope, you would still be as passionate about it in the 10th year as you are in the first. And so for me, write what you know. People would often say to me with A Way of Life, that first film, you know, you must have identified so terribly with the character that was murdered at the beginning of the film. And the film starts with a murder at the beginning and then goes back 6 weeks, and you see how the murder unfolded, and then you see the murder again at the end, towards the end. And I would say, well, you know, that character was, you know, had a lot in common with my father. Thankfully, that's not the way his life ended, thankfully. But that's not the character I identify with the most. Like that character who was killed, I identify with the 17-year-old girl. And the reason why I identify with the 17-year-old girl is because I've been a 17-year-old girl, and I've been excluded, and I felt powerless. And I felt like sometimes my response to the world is, when somebody has further rejected me, I wanted to stamp on their foot and slap their face in the way that my character does. The difference is I had people in my life in the form of, in my case, parents, who taught me to fit in with society and guided me in the ways of what it was like to behave. But if I were in her shoes and I didn't have those, I wasn't lucky enough to have someone in my life that could have given me that guidance. As a 17-year-old girl, I too wanted to stamp on people's feet when the world didn't go according to the way that I wanted it to, or when I felt left out. So just the fact that she was a Welsh 17-year-old white girl and I was a black English girl from Streatham didn't mean that we didn't have anything in common, or that I didn't know her. I knew her, but on the face of it, on paper, it would look like I didn't. So write what you're passionate about. I was passionate about telling her story, because in telling her story, I might be able to present or contribute to a conversation that needed to be had. And I would also hopefully contribute to a conversation that was important for people like me, because when people like this character feel excluded, people like me suffer, because I'm the one they blame.
Right.
I'm a black woman. I'm at the bottom of the food chain when it comes to that stuff. So I'm the one that gets the blame, finally. So that's why I was passionate about that, telling that story. And you know, Belle sits in front of the mirror at some point, and I've never seen it done in an Austen piece. And this was an Austen-esque piece, even though it wasn't Austen, but she sits in front of the mirror and she self-harms. And, I have never physically self-harmed. Wow. But to understand what it feels like when you realize that what you are is apparently a burden on your society, when you are a young woman, understood what that felt like. So I wasn't an aristocrat living in posh you know, 18th century England, but I understood what that felt like. So I would say for those stories that filmmakers want to tell, that they're hungry to tell, make sure your passion and hunger, you know, your cup runneth over in right. that area, and then commit to it.
Yeah, that's great advice. So lastly, what do you hope comes from all of this going forward for filmmakers and just people in general? Like, what is your hope that's going to come from all this?
You mean where we are kind of
and
socially,
just
the, you know, at the
I
moment?
Think, yeah. And I think just at the tipping point of finally, it's like, well, we can't fucking ignore this anymore. We have to really everybody has to really talk about it. We have to fix this. Just as you as a filmmaker, what are you hoping can come from this?
You know, I think it's very, very difficult to separate the writer in me and separate the director in me and take out the filmmaker in me. But I think I speak just as a black woman at this point, you know, just Amma at this point. And my difficulty is, you know, like you, I was around for Rodney King and I was young enough at that time. And I, you know, what you're saying now is where I thought we were then.
I agree.
I really did. I really believed, and because I had that optimism and my whole life laid out in front of me, and my only way to cope with what was going on was to say it has to change. That's what I believed, and I thought it would. And when I watched a video of a man being shot and bleeding to death in his car with his girlfriend sat next to him and his child, you know, her child in the back of the car, and the police officer shaking, you know, that woman having to talk him off of the roof so that she wasn't shot too. All those years, really, after Rodney King? I mean, what do I hope that comes out of this? I hope and I really pray that this is a point where all elements of society understand that we can't ignore it anymore. Am I sure that's going to happen? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Because I've seen it before. But what I know as filmmakers is that what we have, you know, as much as there's the cynic that lives inside me, there is this optimist. I think by our very nature, in some way, there has to be a part of us that's optimistic, because walking into some anybody's office and saying, hey, I got this idea in my head, right? And I need millions of pounds of your money to pay for it. And you'll kind of understand exactly what it is when it's completely finished. But, you know, let me give you 70% of what I'm thinking in my head until then. I mean, for us to kind of get our movies off the ground and to have all of this money spent on our movies, on our stories, there has to be an element of optimism that keeps us, you know,
for sure,
banging on those doors. So the optimist in me says our stories make a difference. The optimist in me, and that's why it's so important that the film industry takes responsibility for, you know, the product that it puts out, and really, really needs to think about that. And so the optimist in me says, oh, I got to keep trying, and I hope my fellow filmmakers will keep trying, and I hope, you know, those emerging filmmakers that are leaving film school or, you know, writing down their stories now, maybe they never went to film school, I didn't, will also keep trying. Because in the end, when we get those stories made, you know, I remember when I was making Belle, and, you know, lots of really clever people told me how this was a, you know, a story for women, and it was women, it's women that bring men to the cinemas, and, you know, for this kind of story, I know that that's been true. But I remember being told that. And then I just remember when the figures really started to break down, how many men were enjoying the film as well. And that's because it's possible to take people for a walk, as I said at the beginning of our chat, for a few minutes in somebody else's shoes, not 100%, but as closely as possible, even when it seems like they come from two entirely different worlds. And that means that we have the possibility to not to change people's minds, I think, in the movie theater, but start the conversations, the kind of conversations that can lead to minds being changed. And I think that's why it's important to tell those stories. And I don't think that that has to always happen in important stories. I never want to lose sight of the important story. I think that it's important that important stories are told. But it means also in telling those, just let us be stories as well. That all of that contributes to having, you know, chiseling away at those sharp edges that society has, particularly when it comes to prejudice and inequality and the treatment, of women and people of color and those of us who are both.
I agree. Well, this is exactly what I wanted, to recreate the conversation that we had had on the phone and then some. Thank you so much for doing this. You're so special, and what you do is so important, and the stuff you're making is so important and so great. And I'm just happy to have met you. I really am. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. Thank you for being you. Thank you for listening. And for those listening, I'll be taking a project to Todd soon. So watch this space.
Thank you so much. Be well.
You too, Todd. Bye for now.
Bye.